Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome one of our own, Dr. Anjali Budwa's daughter, recently, who's been working, I think, with Joya, particularly on questions of gender and poverty in Delhi, and who's going to give us a paper which has a slightly different title from the one advertised. It's The Urban Conquest of the Periphery, Regendering Delhi's Urban Villages. Anjali.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Washbrook, for those kind words, and apologies to everyone for the change of title. When Barbara wrote to me, I just gave the whole thesis title in excitement, and when I mulled over it and thought about it in great details, I thought it's just the right audience to bring such a paper to, in front of whom I could talk in terms of interdisciplinary context. And considering the varied backgrounds everyone is here from, I could take the opportunity to present something which is extremely South Asian in its context. So having grown up in the upmarket South Delhi neighborhood of Panchsheel enclave, I've had right from the beginning a very complex relationship with my own city. It was huge by any standards, and yet among other things, my little pocket of zone of comfort with all its large bungalows, Punjabi upper class residents, big parks and security guards, was surrounded by 200-year-old Jat and Gujar villages with narrow meandering streets and rows of shops on their peripheries. I often accompanied my parents to these villages for everyday necessities, especially when we needed hardware, spare car parts or metal grills. Men with seemingly no occupation were often seen playing cards by the chopal, while village women were almost invisible, glimpsed sometimes making dung cakes in the mornings or through open doorways of their house chopping vegetables in front of the TV. This paper, drawn from my recently completed PhD thesis, is an attempt to understand Delhi's gendered urban spaces and how these were reordered by partition. The main objective is to examine how social space in Delhi was both redefined and remade in the aftermath of partition. While the emphasis is on the social uses and social imaginaries of speciality, it seeks also to understand and present a new socio-economic history of the city. While my thesis explores the question of gender and space in some detail in the context of different spatial zones in Delhi over a long period of time, today I present a very neglected yet extremely significant aspect of that reordering in Delhi's urban fringe, or what we understand as urban villages. The argument runs along the lines that Delhi's urban drive after partition led to the conquest of the periphery, resulting in the assimilation of these villages into the urban fold. This paper argues that the villages did not respond passively to urbanization, but rather reacted to the transition process by becoming both morphologically and economically part of the larger urban area. In turn, this impacted upon, in fascinating and unprecedented ways, familial and gender relations within these communities, just as their interface with the urban world brought changes to their work, life, and livelihood patterns. So there are numerous villages which from time to time were encompassed by the urban drive to acquire more land for housing basically and for industrial purposes as well. The story of impact of partition on Delhi's landscape has many facets. At one level, partition did little to diminish the preeminent position of Delhi as a capital city. Yet after partition, within a short span of time, Delhi became a city of refugees. As refugees became a new property-owning class in the city, there were alterations in patterns of land holding and land use. Delhi changed from being a city of babus, or the government servants, old aristocracies, Jat and Gujar peasants, and chiefly Muslim artisans, to become a city of Hindu and Sikh Punjabi property owners, traders and shopkeepers, and the founders of thousands of new small-scale industries. Before partition, New Delhi was dominated by men, often single males who had come there in search of employment. However, refugee migrations had involved a wholesale move of populations, involving the family as a unit. A considerable number of displaced migrants were women. Thus, the city was feminized by the pressures and imperatives faced by these migrant refugee women. Refugees of India's partition are generally seen as hapless victims of the ethnic strife and hence in need of prompt rehabilitation. And Delhi, the capital city, provided them a safe haven. But this paper presents an alternative history. It argues that behind the story of survival and refugee enterprise in Delhi is also hidden the tale of many villages and communities that were displaced in the process. Their land was acquired, they lost their livelihood in a short span of time, and they witnessed tremendous displacement in an endeavor to rehabilitate the refugee population from Punjab, as new colonies were constructed all over Delhi. In doing so, this paper attempts to make fresh contributions in the field of historiography of India's partition, urban histories, and gender and development studies. First of all, while it focuses on the human face of partition and looks at people and communities, it moves away from refugee-centric approach. This paper brings into examination not only the refugees who migrated amidst violence and trauma, but also the resident population who received them. Second, it contributes in the field of urban history by linking the post-colonial geographies of Delhi together with partition. It looks at spatial transformations in the city and argues that places are not merely physical spaces, but arenas where the lives, mobilities, activities, and everyday routines of people are played out. These are socially constructed entities invested with a range of meanings by the people who inhabit them. By arguing that space was redefined after partition in Delhi, it not only looks at spatial expansion, but also at the changing social identities of places. Third, this paper makes a significant contribution by way of its focus on gender. Gender is a neglected field in urban history, migration studies, and even social and economic history. This paper aims to make an intervention in all these fields by making women visible in the life of the city. It draws on feminist scholarship on women's work in the household, in production and processing, and in the informal sector. This body of work has directed our attention to how their work is often made invisible on account of the fact that women's entry into the labor market is often driven by household exigencies. For many women, this meant they worked all their lives, but their work was regarded nonetheless as supplementary. To understand how social constructions of gender shape the lives and work of women workers, wider social anxieties about women's roles and positions after partition have to be taken into account if we are to understand the regendering of Delhi. This paper seeks to provide such an analysis. A handful of sociologists and anthropologists have conducted ethnographic field-based research on Delhi's urban villages. These studies examine urban development policies and plans and explore some aspects of impact of migration and urbanization on village life. They look at changing patterns of demography, for instance. However, a focus on the village inhabitants' experiences, especially from a gender point of view, is lacking. This paper addresses this gap in the literature by focusing on how age, caste, and religion as other constituents of identity in these villages intersected with gender. By exploring the ways in which different generations of men and women experienced the shift from peasant to urban economies, it seeks to tease out how this transition impacted gender relations and family dynamics within these communities. To begin with, I would set out the trends in the population of rural Delhi over a period of time, and it is necessary to keep in view the total demographic map of Delhi. This graph is instructive in this respect. As the graph demonstrates, in 1901, at the start of the 20th century, the population of urban and rural Delhi was almost equal in size. But its absolute decline vis-a-vis the urban population is clearly perceptible from 1911 onwards. In this year, Delhi was declared the capital of the country, and this change drew a considerable population to the city. But another and more significant reason for this declining rural population indicates a trend towards the urbanization and colonization of rural areas. In 1921, there were 314 inhabited villages in Delhi. Before 1931, a total of 25 villages were brought into expanding urban setting. The main thrust of the urban growth was towards the west and north of the walled city, where colonial administrative headquarters and associated residential and recreational activities needed space. The period from 1931 to 1951 was marked by two significant events, the Second World War and partition of India. Both led to large-scale migrations in Delhi. During the period of the war, the massive influx of people in Delhi created huge pressures for immediate expansion. In consequence, the urban limits of Delhi were extended by another 25 square kilometers and 22 villages lost their land. In 1947, with partition, the population of Delhi almost doubled in a space of just 2 months and increased by more than 90% in a single decade. Delhi was just not prepared. It simply did not have housing and shelter for almost 500,000 people, and thousands of tents were pitched to shelter the uprooted. At this point, the government created a separate Ministry of Relief, later Rehabilitation, to tackle the problems of housing the refugees, which it had recognized as being in need of permanent rehabilitation. Between 1948 and 1952, Delhi Improvement Trust and Central Public Works Department planned new refugee townships on the urban fringe of Delhi. For this purpose, the government acquired the agricultural lands of the villages in the south and west of Delhi. As refugee colonies sprang up, many villages were drawn into the urban fold. With the formulation of Master Plan of Delhi, almost 50 more villages were incorporated within the urban area during this time, the highest at any point in Delhi's history so far. This represented a record increase of 202% in the number of villages incorporated. This map shows the decadal incorporation of villages, and as we can see from 1951 to 61, the acquisition is more intense. Accounts of rehabilitation in Delhi highlight the fact that one of the advantages refugees had in Delhi was that the city had huge vacant land which could be deployed for their resettlement. For instance, VKRV Rao writes, Delhi was fortunate enough to have an open dry land in the south, which provided ample space for urban expansion and where refugee dwellings could be constructed. Ashok Mitra and V.N. Datta also talk about the huge undeveloped tracts of land to the south and west, which could be used for displaced population. However, this paper argues that this characterization of rural land as vacant land ignores the presence of many agricultural communities who were in possession of that land. A closer look at the government gazettes, revenue settlement records, and archival sources reveals that the land included many cultivable tracts. Even those lands deemed as non-cultivable had been a source of land revenue for the state and a means of livelihood for many rural communities who practiced a mixture of agriculture and pastoralism. Thus, the paper argues the refugee rehabilitation enterprise became a means by which the state carried out a ruthless drive for urbanization, which involved complex politics of domination and subordination over people, land, and property. Contemporary accounts affirm the fact that Jat and Gujar communities, the whole family of agricultural laborers, including women and children, worked in the fields. According to archival sources, female workers comprised half of the total working population of rural Delhi in 1931. Land varied in fertility, and on fertile land, the peasants took up to 4 crops in an year. Most farmers preferred to grow vegetables as they were easily marketable. Indeed, the small size of the land holdings made horticulture more profitable than agriculture. A few farmers also planted wheat and pulses in winter. Farmers used traditional methods of farming. Unsurprisingly, they were unable to invest in scientific farming methods since they produced little surplus and most were uncertain about their tenures. Most of the families had cattle and women looked after these animals. Most women had generally been married by their mid-teens and had established homes and relationships with men who were strangers when they married. Their adult life was mostly spent in husband's village, where they were expected to work for the household and bear his children. Along the household jobs, women participated equally in farming, performed agricultural tasks similar to men. Colonial administrators have described the Jatni, or the Jat woman, as an economic treasure for her active participation in the agricultural activities. Contemporary sources and local proverbs all show that women performed almost all equal work associated with threshing and winnowing, collecting fodder, caring for cattle, and processing cow dung into fuel cakes. Some tasks, such as weeding, also fell exclusively on women. To this may be added the extensive work of animal husbandry, which was a necessary supplement to region's economy. The task of caring for cattle with their triple economic value, providing cows for breeding bullocks, producers of milk and producers of manure cum fuel, was all concentrated in the hands of women. In fact, civil servant William Crook noted that women's work may be divided into three kinds: independent labor, that which is supplementary to the husband's work, and lastly, that which is common to both sexes. But he observed, and which is very significant, that at a census, it has generally been found possible only to record the sole or more important occupation of the head of the family, and other members of the household are mentioned as dependents upon him. Thus, the specialization of labor, which was inevitable under the caste organization and the close family system, both tended to check the independence of subordinate members of the family. The wife could practice some major or minor industry, but she would almost always be recorded as assisting in her husband's occupation. Most tasks of rural women were considered household labor and not counted as farm work. The multitask nature of women's work contributed to the underestimation of their engagement in production. The definition of farm woman as assistant, wife, and homemaker rendered her involvement in farm work almost invisible and secondary to primary and publicly prominent tasks in the home. Women lacked high social status and economic standard, despite obviously a valuable contribution to the economy. In a very interesting conversation, the settlement officer, R. McConachie, wrote about the life of a Hindu Jat woman in the course of his account in the following words, which is worth quoting at length. A Jat official was on leave with me, and I asked him about the life of a Jatni, or a Jat woman. He thought that 90% of them are happy in their homes, and that hardly 1% are bad character. And he attributes this to the system of early marriage. He himself was married at 11, and many Hindu peasants believed themselves obliged to their religion to marry their daughters when they are much younger. Continuing, my companion said, "But what I will say is the greatest reason why men and women live happily together is that women look upon themselves as the slaves of their husbands and think it is their duty to do their bidding in everything. And a great reason why they're so virtuous is that they work so hard. My wife rises at 4 and grinds for 1 or 2 hours. And if she has no grinding to do, she says, 'I've had no exercise today. I cannot digest my food.' After the grinding, she heats the water for bath, milks the buffaloes, cleans the house, and prepares the morning meal. At different times in the day, she spins, draws the water from the well, and brings it on her head, one pot set upon another." I asked, "Does she help in field work at all?" He replied, "She helps in everything, except ploughing and sowing. With us, it is a shame for a married woman to sow, for it would mean that you have no man to do it for you. Go and sow is therefore a term of abuse, and only widows do it. If a woman's husband is away, she usually employs a lower caste to do it for her." "What time does she go to bed?" I asked. He said, "At 10. 6 hours of sleep is enough for her. She's very strong." So agrarian communities clearly had a preference for sons over daughters. Despite this discrimination, women were valued as economic assets. This reflects the irony of women's work and labor and its under-recognition in peasant cultures, which devalued females despite their economic contribution. I will come back to women and work in a bit, but before that, I will talk here about the politics of land acquisition, since this is important if we have to understand the process of displacement in these communities. As has been seen, the government acquired the agricultural land of villages in the south and west of the city. The Jat, Gujars, and other agricultural communities who owned the land were paid compensation in cash equivalent to the value of their land, as assessed by the Delhi Improvement Trust and the Land Commissioner of New Delhi, or in the form of land elsewhere. As recalled by many respondents in the course of interviews, this compensation was meager and far below the market value of their land. Archival sources also reveal these discrepancies. Land was acquired under the Displaced Persons Land Acquisition Act of 1948. This act is significant in understanding the complexities of acquisition. Section 3 of the Act on the Notice of Acquisition read thus: whenever it appears to the state government that it is necessary or expedient to acquire speedily any land for resettlement of displaced persons, a notification to that effect shall be published in the Official Gazette, stating the area and the boundaries of the land proposed to be acquired, and the date on which such acquisition will be made, and the competent authority shall cause public notice of the substance of such notification to be given at convenient places or near the land to be acquired. As this statement reveals, the state deemed itself to be an entity controlling most land resources. The Act declared that the state would announce the date of acquisition and the land to be acquired, without taking into consideration the will of the people residing in that area, irrespective of whether the acquisition was acceptable to them or not. It was no less arbitrary in its assessment of the compensation due to be paid to this for this land. In Section 7, on the method of determining compensation, the Act stated the compensation given to the displaced owners was determined by the value of land in 1894 with an added 40%, or the value of land in 1939, whichever was less. However, the market value of land in 1948 had shot up considerably, and that was not a consideration. No fresh valuations were ever carried out, and the owners received compensation much lower than the actual market value of the land. The Delhi Land Reforms Act of 1954 further facilitated this process, whereby cultivable and non-cultivable land was acquired and any rights of proprietors were disowned. Official memos of the Ministry of Works and Housing and Master Plan of Delhi indicate that villages did not get the attention they deserve from policymakers and planners. The ministry was concerned with checking speculation in land in Delhi and acquiring land around it at a reasonable price for expanding capital. Although it was clear that the land for Delhi's expanding population had to come from the surrounding villages, the fate of these villages was barely discussed. The planners involved in the exercise were certainly aware that the engulfing of the villages would affect their inhabitants. Thus, they came up with the concept of urban villages to relocate rural activities within the Lal Jora or the Red Line limits, by which the village remained in theory unaffected by the acquisition around. Red Line zoning had originated as part of land tenure and revenue policies during the colonial period. The area bounded by Red Line is the village land, and around it, abadi or inhabited area, demarcated from village agricultural land that cannot be built upon. Within the Lal Jora area, land is not assessed for revenue and is not subject to building regulations. However, their approach was both impractical and condescending. The acquisition of land was looked upon purely as an administrative and legal issue. As far as officials were concerned, the entire exercise was very mechanical. Land was acquired for urban development, compensation for that acquired land was paid to the rural owners, and that land further developed and allocated for housing to refugees. How the people of these villages, who had only skills related to agriculture and allied activities, would cope with an uncertain urban future with only some cash in hand was not considered at all. No provision was made in the master plan at the ground level. As village after village came to be engulfed by the expansion of the metropolis, they were left to fend for themselves as best as they could, with only the most rudimentary civic amenities. Their buildings were left untouched. The plight of urban villages thus reveals a complete absence of any participatory process in the urban planning of Delhi. This comes out evocatively in some of the interviews I conducted in the region. It's not possible to present all of them here, but a few are absolutely essential to elucidate my argument. One example is of 63 years old Rajkumar Dhaiya, a resident of Shahpur Jat village and a property dealer. He was quite touched when someone was interested in writing about the village and its past, which he thought was somewhere buried in the urban development of Delhi. Later in the evening, Dhaiya introduced me to his family in their home and revealed in the course of the interview. When our fields were acquired, many Jats got claims and compensation in cash or in the form of land elsewhere. We were given a plot in faraway Vikaspuri in outer Delhi, which we accepted, but we had no choice. The government was indifferent to what would happen to our livelihood. We lost our land, and the compensation in the form of plot in a far-lying area was very inconvenient. Land that was acquired at a meager price of rupees 5 per square yard has today shot up to 40,000 square yard. Today, most of us have lost to the housing societies and property speculators and developers who have capitalized on our former land and reaped huge profits in the property boom of Delhi. Dhaiya's family is among the many families in Shahpur Jat that lost their land to urban expansion of Delhi. His words show how the government's offer of an alternative piece of land in a faraway part of Delhi as compensation was viewed by many villagers as unacceptable, as the traditional source of livelihood, family labour and market networks were all tied to their village area. Agriculture declined sharply in these villages, with a corresponding increase in the number of village residents seeking employment outside into various other activities. The decline of agricultural activities in the villages is also revealed in archival sources that show the percentage of people employed in primary sector and rural Delhi fell dramatically from 67% in 1931 to 45% in 1947 and to 38% by 1971. Sources also reveal a trend towards the diversification of economic activity, particularly from 1951 onwards. While the original community was forced to sell their agricultural land, however, villagers were rarely willing to sell vacant land or houses within the village, as retaining control over the village is regarded by most as important to their identity. Hence, accommodation in the village was only available to outsiders on rent for commercial, residential, or manufacturing purposes. So, most of the villages on their peripheries have many shops that are rented out. Some villages have, especially the rented property, has escalated a lot, particularly in Shahpur Jat. The entire row on the periphery is now, it belongs to expensive designer boutiques. At no stage, however, did the municipal agencies respond to these developments by providing civic facilities and development within villages. Any provision of drains, water supplies, and roads that ever came about were a result of local or private initiatives. A report in Delhi newspaper Hindustan Times highlighted this. Unfortunately, urban villages suffer from a lack of infrastructure such as sewerage, water and power supply, due to non-development of infrastructure within these areas. The acuteness of the situation is magnified by high population densities and leads to horrible living conditions during periods of seasonal stress, as in high summers or monsoon rains. This was in stark contrast to the amenities and facilities to at least some refugee colonies built on land acquired from these villages. Even though hastily drawn up and marked by uneven and unbalanced development, the records reveal a concern among authorities to provide basic amenities to the refugee colonies. For instance, in the newly developed refugee townships of Kilkori and Kalkaji, which when established had no arrangements of water supply, the Ministry of Rehabilitation was anxious that people might not be willing to settle there if this was not rectified. Hence, it took special permission from the government of Uttar Pradesh to make use of 20 cubics of raw water from its share of Yamuna River and installed a pumping station at 1 acre land near Okhla. Hand pumps to draw groundwater were provided in colonies like Patel Nagar, Kingsway and Lajpat Nagar to facilitate water supply. Similarly, the ministry made arrangements for the electrification of houses and shops allotted to refugees in Kutub Road, Malkaganj and Patel Nagar. The villagers have experienced major changes over the years, and the villages now form high-density residential areas within the city. Yet, much remains unchanged. The old street patterns are still in place. Growth has been haphazard due to adding on of new construction from time to time. Small shops and enterprises are the main tenants of the villages. However, the villages are in general clearly identifiable, forming an enclave within the newer developments that surround them. The old lanes exist, and I mean, alongside there are shops which are thriving inside the village. While the village men were relatively better assimilated into income-generating activities of the urban market, there was a corresponding loss of women's economic roles, leading to their further seclusion and marginalization within the household and community. Sorry. There has been a steep fall in the number and proportion of female and unskilled workers, which increased the dependency ratio in the majority of these villages between 1951 and 1961. The percentage of working females in the villages fell from 25% in 1931 to 17% in 1951. By 1971, it had crashed drastically to 4%. This was a marked contrast to the refugee women in Delhi during the same decade. The government treated the refugees of partition as victims of national disaster and made endeavors, albeit not always successful, as discussed in my thesis in another chapter, to rehabilitate them. There was a steady rise in the sex ratio in Delhi among the urban women from 677 women in 1941 to 785 women in 1961. Certainly, refugee women became far more central and visible in the life of the city. While Punjabi refugee women carried out a variety of endeavors to survive and sustain their families in Delhi, a reverse trend could be seen in case of urban villages. There, after partition, then gender ideology was refashioned and its asymmetric power relations survived, arguably with greater intensity. Sociologists and anthropologists like Doreen Jacobson, Susan Wadley, Patricia Jeffrey, and Leela Dubey have examined women's marginal status under systems of patriarchy and the impact of social and economic changes on their lives. Studies of women and social change in Third World, and particularly in South Asia, have identified a multiplicity of forces, including urban contact, education, and occupation in shaping women's identities in communities that follow relatively strict norms of patriarchy. Building on this new research, I argue that urbanization does not necessarily improve women's status, and that patriarchal bias inherent in the state conceptions of social change is primarily responsible for socioeconomic vulnerability of these village women. Thus, the paper focuses on the ways in which hierarchical gender relations influence education and employment opportunities for women outside and inside their house. This view is borne out by examination of gender relations in communities that underwent a rapid shift from peasant economy to urban economy after 1947. In the scenario before partition, even though tightly contained within the patriarchal norms, women regularly worked as agricultural laborers. As discussed above, even though they were never allowed to work outside the village, they were nonetheless involved in agricultural production within the village, both in the fields and in post-harvesting activities. In the context of sharp decline of agricultural activities and a concomitant loss of livelihood, villagers joined the urban economic force in urban Delhi, albeit often on terms that they had no power to choose. As their work expanded beyond agriculture, the entrepreneurial opportunities that opened up were only available to men. Village women were denied direct access to urban New Delhi and not allowed to work because of fear of outside influences and a corrupt and dangerous urban world. Some of the interviews again highlight this point very clearly. One respondent, Daljeet Alhawat, a 71-year-old male resident of Chirag Delhi, asserted in the course of an interview, "After partition, Punjabis used all means to survive and the women faced immense hardships. I remember the refugees around our village. Their women used to come and bathe in our wells and look for work in our village. They were desperate to find work, but that looked very old. And I loathe a culture where women are sent out to alien spaces, bathe openly, and roam around looking for work. It was a time of hardship for them, but women are the status of a community. Our bahus and betiyas, daughter-in-laws and daughters, are not shameless. They do not go out and work. Their men are alive. It is against our culture to send them to work with strange men. Women are the pride of the house. Their purity is community's purity. We ensure that our women are well protected, as the Punjabans, the outside world, is very rough and tough. But our women come from a long tradition of agrarian peasant communities, where woman's first obedience is to her household. Daljeet Alawat retired as a primary school teacher in 2002. Despite his education, he feels that a woman's place is first and foremost in her household. He recognizes that Punjabi refugees, including refugee women, have made progress in Delhi, but finds their ways very crude and even shocking. He takes strong pride in his Jat identity, claiming that even though they lost their land and livelihood to government after partition, at least their women have lived a life of dignity. Underlying these protestations, however, one can glean a sense of insecurity among men like Daljeet Alawat from the urban villages who feel threatened in their ability to control their women, their pride in the new situation. In the rapidly changing urban and social milieu after partition, it emerges that in these villages, women were restricted to the household more tightly than ever before, when the community had an agricultural way of life. Although the interplay between men and women in matters concerning mutual and family support was severely unbalanced even during that period, post-colonial changes have considerably increased gender asymmetry within the household. Jat women after partition were not allowed to work outside the home, primarily because the surrounding urban community was perceived as threatening, and the urban men were regarded as untrustworthy outsiders. Also, restricting women's participation in economic activities became a matter of prestige and mark of upward mobility. Writing about North Indian village communities, David Mandelbaum, for instance, has observed that since a family status is in part measured by behavior of its women, wheel restrictions were imposed if a family gains an economic status or seeks social status. An interview with 44-year-old Navjot Dabas, whose name was changed on request, a resident of Shadipur village, reveals more about these subtle shifts. Navjot was born in Bhiwari in a Jat family. She was 16 years at the time of her marriage to Praveen Dabas, now a 56-year-old bus conductor, working for Delhi Transport Corporation. Praveen Dabas had to enter the transport service sector to make a living, as the family had lost their ancestral working fields to the government. But the entire clan continued to live in the village. Deep within the crowded village is their household, where Navjot lives with Praveen, his aged parents, and their four children. Navjot preferred to be interviewed in her kitchen, her rasoi. Perhaps she associated the rasoi with her private space while making preparations for the dinner. Her head was veiled and she was sweating profusely in the heat as she made chapatis or flatbreads on hot stove for her 85-year-old mother-in-law. On being asked about her life, she disclosed, "Who would like to have daughters when you have to pay dowries to protect them? When I was expecting my first child, my husband had told me very clearly, if it's a girl child, we have to abort. But luckily, I gave birth to a boy, and my mother-in-law was so happy. However, after that, I have had to abort girls twice, simply because we could not have looked after them, their marriages, etc. After all, my husband has a limited salary, and I am a dutiful wife, and do as my husband says. I have to live with them all of my life, and I had better abide by the family norms." When asked if she ever thought of working, she replied, "Are you joking? In our clan, women don't work outside the village. We are not so degraded that we go out to work with men and women from here and there. I have enough housework to do anyway. My mother used to work in our family farm, but then things were different. That was like our own work. But now so many outsiders live in Delhi. Migrations are ever increasing, and their culture is so different. Women work only if their men can't earn. My husband has a government job, and I have three sons. I have nothing to worry about." Later in the evening, I interviewed her mother-in-law, Yamuna Devi, in their living room. Yamuna Devi leads a fairly active life, but refuses to do any housework as she has a daughter-in-law to serve her everyday need. Yamuna Devi remembers Shadipur as a farmland where she would work as part of family labor. She had a considerable social life at that time and took special interests in marriage ceremonies of the community. She acknowledged that she had combined field work with an entire load of housework and never received any money for it. When asked whether she misses her earlier life before acquisition of land, she said, "I definitely miss my earlier days when the village was ours and we had enjoyed our cultivation. Life was very hard as I got up very early to go to the farm, make dung cakes for fuel and brought water from the well among other things. But then Delhi belonged to us. We had our clans dispersed around whom we could visit sometimes. We were more established in the city then. Now we have a divided identity. We are villagers among city dwellers. Our village is surrounded by posh localities. We are integrated into the life of the city, but are still considered backward and undeveloped because our villages do not have those facilities. We want to be proud of our heritage and culture, but who wants to remember us in our farmlands?" Yamuna Devi informed me that her community still prefers to marry within the same clan, as this helps in maintaining the purity and name of the community. On being asked if she was dissatisfied with any aspect of her life and communities these days, she said, "They, the men, consume too much alcohol because they have no work, and this is beginning to affect to find suitable wives for them." Yamuna Devi's interview is also reflective of the fact that intra-community marriages have proliferated as women chosen from the same caste and community are seen as representing an agricultural way of life and as a means of bringing that tradition back to the Jat community. Her interview is also reflective of a sort of crisis of masculinity in these villages, where in an era of new technologies, globalization and rampant consumerism, unemployed men dissatisfied with their jobs are turning more aggressive and violent, worsening gender equations. So we often find them sitting on the village chapals or tea shops or leaning against cars and motorbikes, something that is never allowed to village girls. The increasing urbanized context has led to increasing marginalization of village women as the community came to feel threatened by the encroachment of city and had to negotiate its identity. Son preference and daughter neglect appear to have intensified rather than decline in urban villages. Sons are to be seen more than ever as family's sole economic assets that bring prestige and strength, but daughters are perceived as an economic and moral burden. Practices like sex-selective abortions have intensified as villagers have access to new reproductive technologies nearby. In some cases, people in the villages have used urban contacts to enhance their status, and they have begun to align themselves both with the educated, affluent, and modern society of Delhi. A few resourceful and industrious Jat families have deployed the government's compensation money successfully to buy land in far-flung areas or by investing in business and real estates, which have led to a greater degree of acculturation to urban society. However, less successful Jat families have tended to exaggerate their agricultural identity and idealize the cultural practices associated with traditional Jat identities as means of maintaining community boundaries between the Jat population and the surrounding multi-ethnic urban population. The levels of acculturation to urban New Delhi notwithstanding, a number of urban villages tend to express a sense of nostalgia for a rather idealized version of their old life in rural times. To conclude, after partition, Delhi witnessed tremendous changes in its demographic and spatial profile. The influx of refugee population from Punjab brought significant strains in the rural world of Delhi, as many villages were completely absorbed into the urban fold, and their agricultural land was acquired to house the refugee population. However, urban planning in Delhi became a means of promoting idealized landscapes deemed appropriate for the capital city of the new nation, and that rehabilitation ended up being more about rehabilitating Delhi than about rehabilitating refugees. Thus far from being unconnected with the practicalities of the situation, the process of land acquisition and rehabilitation reinforced and created new spatial and social hierarchies by maintaining segregated spatial patterns based on gender, class, and caste. The loss of land and livelihood forced these villages to evolve survival strategies to assimilate themselves into income-generating activities in urban market. However, contrary to the view that urbanization invariably improves women's lives by reducing restrictions and seclusion, the women of these communities have been far more restricted, secluded, and marginalized than when the community had an agricultural way of life. The new urban capitalist economy of these urban villages has led to a reinforcement rather than a decline of traditional patriarchal ideologies. Women's roles as agricultural laborers have been replaced by roles within the household, and they are increasingly perceived as carriers of tradition as a means of maintaining customs and practices associated with the community's idealized agrarian past. Uneven levels of economic participation and rates of acculturation to the urban world have thus led to the emergence of an economically marginalized, spatially segregated, gendered underclass in these urban villages. Thank you.